Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, Bobbi Osteen discusses the mysterious art of editing and her new book, The Invisible Cut. And we're joined by the crew from the South by Southwest Film Fest favorite, Best Worst Movie, coming up next on Movie Geeks United. There, everybody. This is Movie Geeks United. Welcome to the show, whether you're listening live or on archive. Welcome. Appreciate your support. This is Jamie speaking, and that's Jerry right there. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm very good. That was an exciting show we had Wednesday.
Very exciting.
And I've kind of been on a high ever since.
I think we all have.
John Voight and Burt Young and biographer Nick Dawson talking about the works of Hal Ashby. And the lost film of Hal Ashby that's premiering later this early next month at the Sarasota Film Festival.
Right.
A new Ashby film. I can't wait. I'm biting my nails.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a good conversation. And we have another terrific program tonight. And we're going to start out by talking about an art form that is very mysterious to a lot of people, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show. And a terrific new book that lays it all out step by step and gives movie fans a greater appreciation and understanding of what is behind the art of editing. And later on in the program, we'll be talking in a roundtable type discussion to the crew of a new documentary called Best Worst Movie, which chronicles the making of and the subsequent phenomenon behind one of the worst movies ever made, Troll 2.
Wow.
And it's actually a really fun conversation because all of these people are a part of something that has caught on the world over. People have parties for this movie, and it really is kind of a celebratory phenomenon, this film. And we'll have four of the cast members from that film on, and it's a lot of fun, so stay tuned for that. But you ready to get the show started?
Let's get it started because we need to talk about editing because it's something we don't talk a lot about on this show, and it's probably the most important part of making a film work.
Oh, I definitely so. It's
yeah.
Like you're saying, it's probably the most elusive of all the cinematic arts. But
it is.
In her new book, The Invisible Cut, How Editors Make Movie Magic, acclaimed Emmy-nominated editor Bobbi Osteen breaks down the process step by step, dissecting scenes from 9 landmark films, including 12 Angry Men, Chinatown, and The French Connection. Mrs. Osteen was married to legendary editor Sam Osteen for 23 years prior to his passing, and Mr. Osteen, of course, is responsible for editing some of the greatest films of our time, including Chinatown and The Graduate and Cool Hand Luke and on and on and on. Her previous book, Cut to the Chase, is a series of insightful conversations between Osteen and her husband. You can purchase the new book, The Invisible Cut, by clicking on the front cover icon on our homepage right there. And we are just thrilled to have her here. It's a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show Mrs. Bobbi Osteen. Mrs. Osteen, hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's a great pleasure for us.
Well, it's a pleasure for me, too.
Tell me a little bit about your background. Your father was an editor of quite a bit of acclaim behind classics like Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid, correct?
Correct. And in a way, it's a tribute to both Sam and my father to have used 3 of their films in total in my book. But also, basically, the 9 movies are classics, and they all represent different genres.
Mm-hmm.
And each genre requires a different approach for an editor. So I have a comedy scene, which is The Graduate, two comedy scenes, actually. A suspense scene, which is Rear Window. A sex scene, which is Body Heat. And I have montages, Big Chill and Butch Cassidy. And then I have the classic chase scene in French Connection.
Yes.
And 12 Angry Men is an interesting movie because you have 12 people sitting around a table, which is a nightmare for an editor, or a potential nightmare for an editor, and how they got around that potential nightmare. And so one of the reasons why I chose actually Big Chill and Body Heat is because I wanted to interview Carol Littleton, who is another amazing editor.
Phenomenal, yeah.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And she's incredibly articulate, but she's also has a female sensibility, which is very interesting, especially for Body Heat, which is...
for the erotic scenes in Body Heat.
Erotic scene.
Yeah.
And Lawrence Kasdan, the director, hired her not only because of her talent and sensibility, but also he really wanted a woman editor. He wanted implicit sexuality rather than pornography.
Yes.
And that movie, the scene I use actually, is a less graphic scene than subsequent sex scenes in the movie, but it's the most erotic because of the psychology behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And
I agree. Yeah.
So what was really great about using Carol was that I have these frame grabs that represent the actual cuts in every scene. So you have the last frame of one shot and then the first frame of the following shot, and you actually see the edits, which has never been done before in a book before.
It is very unique, and
yeah.
I would think because of what we've been discussing, the elusive nature of the art form itself, that it is difficult to speak about unless you're using those kinds of examples in illustrating.
It's true, because it's a visual art, and as you said, it's very mysterious, and it's really about trickery and manipulation, and it's show and tell. And it's, you know, there have been so many books about editing that maybe the text would be interesting, but it's very hard to really grasp the concept unless you see what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've read several books on editing, and this by far is the best that I've seen, the one that I've walked away from, and I really found that I knew the mechanics of these different films and the decision-making that went in behind these cuts. Tell me a little bit about the personality of the editor. You obviously come from a father who was a famous editor in his own right, and later you married Sam, and you're an acclaimed editor as well. What is the mentality? What are the personality traits? Do editors tend to be meticulous people, do you think?
They, believe it or not, I mean, you can tell I'm not a nonverbal person by listening to me, but most editors are, by nature, nonverbal. They're really not, you could ask an editor why he made a particular cut, and the most obvious response might be, it just felt right, I don't know.
Right.
Which can
well,
be
that
really
makes a lot of sense, though. That makes a lot of sense.
It's very instinctual. And people who are visually oriented are not necessarily verbal. But I think editors are, the ones I mentioned are, I would say this is not true of, but there are many editors who are frustrated and feel unappreciated because it is so mysterious. And you know, in a way, they feel they know more than any other person on the filmmaking team about the film itself and even technical knowledge, and they can be frustrated, but the better editors and the wiser editors will be team players and realize that there is a way to work with a director and make it a happy marriage, and you're not saving a movie, but you're the end of the line, you're the magic maker, and it's, I mean, I have to say, my father and Sam both absolutely loved their work.
Mm-hmm.
They loved the puzzles. They loved lying in bed at night and trying to figure out. It was endless. You could never be satisfied, but yet it was a thrilling It was a thrilling challenge.
Yeah.
And I think most editors, if anything, they just want to work more, but they're not, they love to go to work.
Mm-hmm. You spoke about that the editing process, I've heard oftentimes that it is considered almost the final draft of the screenplay in a way.
It is.
Yeah, and the relationship between the editor and the director, and you have a great chapter in your book on this process. The director collaborates with the editor more closely than anyone on the film, doesn't it?
They will spend more time together than any other two crew members, basically, because the editor is there from the beginning to the very end, and holding the director's hand at the very end when there's tremendous pressure. When the film is going out in the cruel, cold world, you know, and being judged, and it's the last place to make the movie what it is, and the editor has to be very empathetic to the director too, because the director always has to compromise his vision in every movie quite a bit. Every stage of the filmmaking process leaves behind problems and compromises, and he has to face that reality in the cutting room. And so I say in my book that, you know, empathy and flexibility and humor is as important as talent and knowledge.
Yeah.
And the marriage is, in the best case scenario, it's give and take and trust, and I'll try anything, you know, not letting ego get in the way, pick your battles, you know, don't try to be right.
Yeah, exactly. And another quality that an editor has to have, as well as a director, I would imagine, and this to me would be the toughest, and you mentioned it in your book, a tremendous amount of concentration, because when you're living with something for that long, sometimes I would think it would be hard to stand back and look at the whole objectively.
But it's true, but the editor, that's part of his or her responsibility, is to be objective, because he is he or she, or I should always say she because people usually say he, is the audience, and they have to be the ones that remind the director and stand outside of the film and say, what would the audience want right now? Who are they rooting for? Are they confused about the story? And it's so difficult for a director who's so emotionally invested in his baby to stand outside and be audience. And it's really, you know, as I say in my book, the director has to have his hand on the pulse of the audience at all times when they're bored. You know, there's another thing that is sort of part of this, which is there's a great rule of thumb, which is movie first, scene second, moment third.
Yes, yeah.
And that has a lot to do with the director holding precious certain moments, certain lines, that the movie, every cut that's made, the director and editor must remember the movie, the overall movie must be always thought of.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene second and the moment third. Don't hold on to a great line that you love because your mother said it or something like that,
right,
because it may not work in the overall movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Tell me what your take on editing is in terms of, can it save a less than stellar movie, and does it always work better when you're working with great material?
Always.
Yeah.
You know, there are probably brilliant editors out there who have never had good material to work with, you know, who may have. I would say that Sam said in Cut to the Chase, the other book you mentioned that is based on interviews I did with him, I said, what is the best editing feat you ever accomplished? And he said, Dry White Season, which was this terribly conceived. There was no story. There was no focus on the characters, and he made it into a viable movie.
Huh. That was
the Marlon Brando
apartheid.
Dry White Season.
Yeah.
And he found he he was so proud that it actually wasn't a great movie, but it was a decent movie. And, you know, I think that movies are not saved in the cutting room, by the way. I just want to tell you that.
Okay.
you don't think they are. Even if it's something, like you were saying, something really bad just can't be saved?
No, it can't be saved.
I believe that. I saw a couple of instances of those the last couple of weeks, but yeah.
Yeah, you can't, I mean, you can't make something that's not there. And you can, when I asked Sam about that, he said, what that usually means is the movie was screwed up in the cutting room in the first place, and then someone saved it. That can happen, and that happens a lot.
Right.
And in that case, you would say, oh, it was saved in the cutting room, but the potential was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you have some favorite examples of sequences that perhaps were not conceived a certain way in the scripting or the shooting stage, but that editing brought a whole new dimension to?
Oh, I have a great example of that.
Cool.
you probably know this. A lot of your listeners probably do, too. The iconic scene where Mrs. Robinson traps Benjamin in the bedroom and she's naked.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that scene?
Yeah, of course I do remember that.
I think every male in this chat room on the show remembers that scene.
That's right.
Well, that scene, because it was such a hot scene and a tricky scene to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
I have the line script of that movie. So a line script is basically vertical lines that run through the page and show you which angles were used and for what parts of the scene. And there were 18 shots that were not used in that scene, and only 3 for the meat of that scene. And this is what happened. Mrs. Robinson comes in, she slams the door, she bars herself in front of the door, and Benjamin is trapped, and he's shocked. And she's proposing an affair. So Sam cut it together, and the original idea was there would be a close shot of Benjamin, a close shot of Mrs. Robinson, shots of her breasts, shots of her stomach. And he put it together, and it wasn't funny. And he couldn't figure out why. So he found an outtake, which is a shot that wasn't originally selected in dailies, and he printed that up, and it was shot from behind Mrs. Robinson's shoulder, looking, focusing on Benjamin's face. So you always know where Mrs. Robinson is in relation to Benjamin, but you don't see her face.
Right.
So the entire scene is that shot of him saying, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, and she's talking, but you don't have to see her talk. You just, you know what she's saying. But this escalating panic and fear and shock is so, it's a brilliant performance, of course. Dustin Hoffman completely, if he hadn't held up his end, it wouldn't work. But there was something about it that made it funnier, that this disembodied voice, you know, of Mrs. Robinson and this face of, you know, this escalating panic was hilarious. And he also, it was freed him to experiment, and he did subliminal editing, which had hardly ever been done before, where he used 3 frames actually registers. You kind of see it, but you don't completely see it. So he did this experimental subliminal shots of her breasts and her stomach. It's sort of like he can't look at her, but he can't look away. It sort of had that effect.
So that was an
example of an editor not using all, they had all these angles of full shots, side shots, you know, and he just threw it all out and just focused on that one shot of Benjamin and the subliminal cuts.
Wow. That is an extraordinary sequence, and actually one of the great shots, the most iconic shots in the history of movies, when you see Benjamin from the vantage point of Mrs. Robinson's leg, I believe it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a terrific shot.
Well, that because that scene, which was 2 scenes previous to that,
if you
really look at all those shots, they're all about power position, that he's so powerless, and she keeps trapping him. She says, I can't be home alone. Did you know I'm an alcoholic? I'm very neurotic. She keeps doing these things that just throw him, and he becomes smaller and smaller until he's inside her bent leg. You know, it's like he's trapped visually and psychologically. And as she progressively does that to him in that scene, the emphasis is always on her in the foreground and him
mm-hmm.
being smaller in the background.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about certain directors and their styles, their techniques when it comes to the editing of their picture. Probably the most infamous of these is Alfred Hitchcock, and you cover some of his shooting techniques in your book. He really did shoot the film for the edit, didn't he?
He was
very little
yeah,
fat.
He was done by the time he got to the movie set. He was done. He had already shot the whole movie in his head. He had drawn every single shot, and he never even went to dailies. He never even ran opticals. He didn't care anymore. He was almost bored. And it was really, I mean, normally for a director to shoot camera cut, which means basically you preconceive every shot, is really risky, because if you get to the cutting room and you say, oh, I needed that angle,
mm-hmm.
you know, where is it? I don't have it. He was so confident and had such brilliant visual, spatial, psychological insights that he knew exactly what he wanted, and he had virtually no trims. I mean, leftover film, you know.
Yeah, which is unheard of.
He had, like, it's usually 40-1 shot film to edited film, and he had like 10 minutes of trims. I mean, he had 1% at most.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is incredible. Tell me about the trends in editing, starting with the computer. I would think computerized film editing has obviously transformed that industry. Do you miss actually holding film and cutting film, or is it just a delight to work on computer now?
I think it's like everything else. I think there are pluses and minuses to every new phase.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the beauty of the Moviola was that it was very intimidating, and nobody could run it except the editor, and editors could get angry and let the film get chewed up if they didn't want the director to come in the room. Or,
mm-hmm.
But only two people could view it at a time. It stayed in the cutting room. You know, now everybody can get copies of dailies and cut film. It's much more accessible, so that precious power and privacy, you know, that the editor and director had in the cutting room is gone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's too bad, you know. But the beauty of computers is that you can do anything and undo it. I mean, you had to worry about splices, and every splice would show. And so if you couldn't do 10 versions. You
mm-hmm.
couldn't try something upside down and backwards and say it doesn't matter because we can always do it over again.
Right.
And
right.
That really frees up. Although if you're indecisive, it could be a problem because you could go crazy. But I think overall, I think it frees the editor up.
Yeah. I notice that, and this is nothing new. I think people a lot of times associate it with the MTV generation, but it's spoken about a lot, the very fast cutting style that has been in vogue for a while now. It's getting a little bit better now, but it almost seems that sometimes style dictates the content as opposed to the opposite. They want something very fast and quick because they think that the audiences have a very short attention span. what do you think of that style? Do you think that that's detrimental to movies?
I don't know. I think, honestly, I don't think it's always true. I think that, you know, you can see a movie like Revolutionary Road,
yeah.
which is a very classic editing style. It's very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it suits the material.
Mm-hmm.
But I think depending on the movie, I think that it is true. I mean, the editor does have to be aware that the people's attention spans are shorter. But there's also people are able to absorb information a lot quicker, so you kind of have the freedom to do very intricate plotting, and I think that's that's a nice thing.
Yeah.
But I don't really believe that that's been thrown out the window, the quiet editing style, mm-hmm. you know, in a dialogue scene where there's a lot of tension. I think smart filmmakers know when to be quiet and know when to be fast and noisy, and I'm not afraid that that will be lost on a smart filmmaker.
Well, one of my all-time favorite films is probably the greatest example of that kind of cutting style, the very fast-paced, multi-format style. I don't know if you agree with this, but I thought that Stone's JFK was one of the most remarkably edited films I've seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. But part of the discipline is knowing when not to cut as much as when to cut, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I would say that cutting a dialogue scene, mm-hmm. say, well, especially a dinner table scene, mm-hmm. which is a nightmare, but no, any dialogue scene that has a lot of tension, a lot of subtext, an editor will spend a lot more time on a scene like that than he will for a car chase. You know,
yeah.
it may look flashy and you may be more aware of the cuts, but the invisible cuts, the ones that just pull you along and you don't really know why how you're being manipulated, but you are, those really are the ones that test who, you know, separates the men from the boys as far as editing goes, you know.
Yeah.
Who really understand the screenplay and the performances and, you know, and it's hard because you're married to the script, you know, you're locked into the words and you don't have as much freedom.
Yeah, I would think, I always hear that said from directors that group scenes, dinner table scenes, et cetera, that you're discussing, are always the nightmares because it's very tricky to keep a handle on the different perspectives, the different eye lines, you know, whose point of view we're using when you're dealing with so many characters. So that,
and then you have to, you know, you have to, what if somebody's raising their fork and then the next, and their best performance is now their fork, where's the fork, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. but then you don't have to worry about that. You have to know what's in the audience's heart and mind at all time, and they may not notice it. I mean,
yeah.
a smart editor will not worry about matching. You know, they will think about where is the audience looking. It's like a magician. The magician knows where the eye is focused. He knows what the audience wants, what the audience thinks, and you know. But it's true. The eye. Oh, and crossing the line, the stage line, is a nightmare.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, you have to look left to right, or oh, he's looking the wrong way, or oh no, we have to cut to that actor. He was a terrible actor, but we have to keep him alive in the scene. You know,
that's just it. I mean, that's indicative of what we're talking about. How this is such an invisible art, and we take it for granted. But there's a whole catalog of issues and decision making that has to go into just making it seem seamless. And it's interesting that you bring up continuity because I just read an article on Scorsese the other day, and he is a filmmaker that's not known for great continuity, but
right.
it doesn't matter because there's such energy associated with his cutting style.
Yeah, I mean, she's a brilliant, Thelma Schumacher's a brilliant editor.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
yeah.
a big fan of hers. And, you know, it's also interesting because and this is why editors can be frustrated, too, is you never know. Even a fellow editor can watch a movie and have no idea what the editor had to work with and what the challenges were, how much the editor, I mean, this is very unusual. The editor could have made no creative decisions or made all of the creative decisions. The editor may have had easy film to work with. I mean, Scorsese's film is probably exciting, but also very challenging because it's so dynamic. It's the same with Polanski. Sam found that Polanski's shooting style was the most brilliant he'd ever seen, but it was like a can of worms because, you know, all his master shots were moving. He never had a static shot ever.
Mm.
So every time you had to cut in close, you're cutting into something that's moving.
Yeah.
And changing, and every take was different. And I have, I'm not speaking with authority about Scorsese, but I would imagine that his footage is also very kinetic, very exciting, and very challenging.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah. This book is fantastic, and I strongly urge every fan of film to pick it up. It's called The Invisible Cut, How Editors Make Movie Magic, and you can purchase it right now from our homepage. It is a great, enlightening, and entertaining read. And Bobby, thank you so much for your time tonight.
And I also would encourage any editors or filmmakers to go on my website, bobbyosteen.com. I welcome your input and reactions. I have excerpts from both my books. And it was a pleasure talking to you both.
Oh, thank you.
You too.
It was a pleasure on our part, too. Trust me.
Okay, thank you.
Come back anytime.
Okay, thanks.
Okay,
oh,
thanks
and by
so much.
The way, Angelina Jolie, you said we have to mention it once. I heard you.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
Bless you. Bless you.
Okay,
bless you.
Welcome.
Angelina Jolie.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Bobby Osteen. That's a conversation that we had prior to coming on the air, where we had our Hal Ashby show on Wednesday, and Mr. Voigt made one mention of Angelina Jolie, and we checked it. It made newspapers in India over the
weekend. Folks, India.
The coverage
keep
of
that
our
in
show.
Mind.
So I told Jerry, and I guess Mrs. Osteen overheard, I said, no matter what, we have to mention Angelina Jolie at least once during every show, and she came through for us. Look at that.
I mean, that's incredible. That is just incredible.
What more could you want from a guest? Great artist, a great writer, a great editor, and this is a great book, and just dozens and dozens of screen grabs, so you can see moment by moment the decision making that went into, like she said, one of the erotic scenes in Body Heat. From a female editor's perspective, the French Connection, the infamous chase scene and the French Connection.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in The Godfather, the baptism sequence and the settling of the score.
The intercutting, yeah.
Yeah, it's all very important. Editing is really where it all comes together. You know
another interesting editing trend now, and I think it's in the construction of script as well, obviously, but telling a story backwards, for lack of a better term.
Right.
You know, playing with time, manipulating time to an even greater extent than we're used to with films.
That's really taking off. Fiction, really, and maybe even before that, to be very honest. But
yeah, and I look at Out of Sight. I look at something like Soderbergh or Out of Sight.
Out of Sight, yeah.
That great love scene in that film, but everybody walked away from, and that's what they remembered, the inner cutting of that. Good, great stuff. Editing is, that's where the movie's really, really given life to. We appreciate everybody joining us tonight. We actually have a caller on the line. You want to take this caller?
Yeah, right. Let's take it. Please,
okay.
Yeah, let's do that.
We have a 732 area code. 732, go ahead.
Hello, how are you?
Hey there, how are you, sir?
Yeah, it's Richard Pepperman. I've been on your show before.
Yes.
How are you guys?
How are you?
I'm fine, and I was enjoying listening to Bobby Osteen, and as usual, your great questions.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, there are questions that usually aren't even considered, and they really get to the heart of the more important things. The only reason I called in, Bobby Osteen told me she was going to be on. I was really happy to hear that news. And for all of your listeners, she was probably being abundantly humble. For all of the people who were listening and having a great time listening to Bobby Osteen, I am happy to participate in something she's doing, in part because of the publication of her new book Showbiz Software on the 30th of March at 6:30, and
okay.
You're located on 19th Street in New York. I think it is.
19th Street.
I'm going to get the address wrong, but it's It's in New York City at Showbiz Software. Here, I got the address. It's 21st Street, 19 West 21st Street, and she's going to be doing a seminar and showing some of the scenes she was talking about tonight.
Oh, cool.
Oh, wow. And right. Will you'll be participating in that as well? Or?
Yeah, I'm happy that I was asked to co-present a seminar with her.
I think that would be so valuable, actually, to have you guys there and to actually show the scenes from the films, and I would imagine you're breaking them down and you could actually physically see how they work.
Yep, they're having a giant flat screen for us to use, so it should be terrific. I think they seat only 50, so I'm hoping this doesn't lead to another disaster in New York City with the models.
The top model
thing,
right?
No pretty women show up, please.
Okay, all right, there you heard it, right there.
Okay, guys, nice talking to you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Pepperman. I appreciate it.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Okay,
and before we leave the subject of editing, I saw a great documentary about 5 years ago called The Cutting Edge, The Magic of Movie Editing, by Wendy Apple, which I strongly recommend to everyone. Anyone who's interested in editing, you can get it from Netflix. You can watch it on their Instant Films, and it's worth your time. They interview a lot of famous editors and the directors and the relationship between directors and editors. Fascinating documentary.
Yeah, I remember seeing that, and I think it took place, I remember seeing some of, forgive me, I forgot his name, I think he's been Coppola's longtime editor.
Walter Murch, right, Walter?
Walter Murch. How could I forget Walter Murch?
That's all right. These names, you see, but they, you just really sort of said it, we don't always remember, and they're like the guys really who make this all the women, like Tarantino's longtime editor. She said that my husband said, well, you should just marry Quentin because you're never home for me.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so.
And Mr. Pepperman, who we just heard from, he has another great book out on film editing, The Eye is Quicker. I really encourage everyone to pick that up as well. That's another one that I've read that has been incredibly illuminating on the process. So this has been a great conversation on editing. Let's talk about the opposite end of the spectrum here. Let's talk about films that can't be saved in editing.
Okay.
Namely, a film like Troll 2. How do you like that segue? Let me give the story for those that aren't privy to this through previous announcements of this show. There was a film, I believe it was released in the early 80s, called Troll 2. It was renamed Troll 2 in post. It had nothing to do with the first Troll film. They just thought they could sell more tickets if they're associated with that first film. By all accounts, a terrible film, but it has grown in popularity over the years. It's gained cult status, and people throw parties for it. It's an international kind of phenomenon that's grown from this. Much to the surprise of the film's participants. One of those participants was a 10-year-old boy who was hired to make Troll 2. And he's a filmmaker. He's kept in the filmmaking game as an actor and a filmmaker. And he looked and he saw, he was receiving many emails that this is a great film. We have a great time with it. It's our favorite movie. It's right up there with Shawshank and all of this stuff.
Wow.
I'm dead serious. So this is a great story. And he said, I want to get together some of my fellow cast members from this, and I want to make a documentary about this phenomenon, exploring this community of people. And also, like I mentioned last week, people that, very few of them are still in the filmmaking business, but they were a part of something that became much larger than themselves, much to their surprise. And it's really been a high point of their life's journey. And so the young 10-year-old boy from the original film set out to direct a documentary. He called it Best Worst Movie. That young man's name is Michael Stevenson.
Mm-hmm.
And in this conversation, we speak to Michael Stevenson and his co-stars from Troll 2, George Hardy, Darren Ewing, and Jason Wright. And George Hardy is a dentist. He was when he took a kind of a 6 or 7 week sabbatical from his practice to shoot Troll 2, and he's still a dentist today. And he has a very interesting story as well, and they follow him quite a bit in this film. It was the hit of this year's South by Southwest Film Festival. People went crazy for it. And so this conversation is a lot of fun. We begin the conversation by asking everyone how the Troll 2 project came to them, starting with the Best Worst Movie director, Michael Stevenson. So I hope you guys all enjoy this.
My whole life I've been looking for the holy grail of bad movies. And this is like the top notch. Like, you couldn't get any better than this.
Troll 2 has got the worst direction. Acting.
What are you doing to my son?
You can tell George is a special effects.
Midgets in potato sacks.
It looks like something the little second graders could make, those masks.
The most ridiculous plot of any movie I've ever seen.
We would take the script and we would open it and we would try to decipher what it meant.
No one, the whole crew that did this movie with us, spoke English.
And I remember thinking, this isn't going to work. But at that point in time, I just stopped asking questions.
Bad food is bad, and bad books are bad, but bad movies are not always bad.
Thank you all for coming to the 5th annual Los Angeles Troll 2 Party.
I think there's a subculture in our society that really revels in bad movies. And Troll 2 would be like the Citizen Kane.
Troll 2 is a religion! A religion! It changed my life.
Hi, my name's Adam. I'm the one that brought Troll 2 to Iraq.
I feel that everyone needs to see this movie.
You guys have Troll 2.
That is in the holy section.
The holy section?
Yeah.
Both are on here, but it's pointing to Troll 2, right?
That's the one that deserves the holy.
I was 10 and a half years old, and it was one of my first auditions, actually. I had just signed up with a local agency there in Salt Lake City, Utah, and the agency called my parents and said, good news, we've got this great horror movie that's coming into town, and there's a role that would be perfect for Michael, and yeah, that's kind of where it all started.
Mm. And Darren, how about you?
I was a theater student in the Weber State University theater department, and I had just gotten an agent myself. This was only about the second audition that I'd ever been called into, and I was tasked a week later, and it was in Troll 2, it's a fairly sizable part, and so I was just ecstatic because I thought I was going to be on the fast track to stardom because I got cast in Troll 2.
Right.
Just right off the bat, you know. And so I was so excited I could hardly contain myself.
I bet. And Dr. George, how about you, sir?
Well, yeah, I was actually practicing dentistry in Salt Lake City, and I cannot remember if I had an agent or not, but I think Irene Saxon did call and Saxon House Agency in Salt Lake, and I remember thinking, am I crazy for doing this? You know, I'm not an actor, but one of my friends kind of enticed me to get an agent in Salt Lake, and I'd taken a few acting classes. And so I went up and auditioned, and I just remember going up the stairs, and there were all these guys, you know, around my age. I was 34 at the time, and I played Michael's dad, and I interviewed in this smoke-filled room. You couldn't even see the other side of the room, and in Utah no one smokes, but this room was full of smoke, and all these non-English speaking Italians are in there, and I remember they just gave me a script cold and read it, and I remember reading that script, and finally Claudio, action, one more action or something like that, and anyway, I ended up next day getting a phone call from Irene Saxon. She says, you got the part. You're the second lead, or you know, one of the leads in this film. You play the dad, and I just went, "Oh my gosh, should I do this or not?" And I asked more questions. I asked more and more questions, like, you know, tell me more about this movie. What I don't understand about this movie. And she wouldn't give me any information. I just thought, "Oh my, if I don't do this, I'll never, you know, I'll probably never have this opportunity again. Why not take it?"
Sure. And did you had to break away briefly from your
practice? Well, I was telling Michael, exactly. It was a 3-week shoot, non-SAG film, got paid $1,500. But I remember some days I'd go in and practice dentistry, and on the days we wouldn't shoot, I'd just beg him if I could just break away and go see a few patients. And so, I was shooting and seeing patients at the same time.
Wow. And yeah. Jason, how about you?
I was 17 years old, just moving into the high school, my high school senior year, and getting ready for high school football. And I actually wasn't going to go to the audition because I was worried if I got the part, it would interfere with football. But I didn't think for a second I'd get the part. So I went to it, auditioned. The next day I got a call, said that I had made it.
Wow. Were any of you, were all of you aware of the kind of film that you were doing
For me, you know, the thing I remember is once I got the part, the script was sent to my dad. And I remember my dad reading through the script and at the end kind of having this furrowed brow and, you know, this questionable look on his face and saying something like, "Michael, I don't know. This is a really strange movie. Are you sure you want to do this?" And, of course, you know, as a 10-year-old, it was like a dream come true. I mean, I was the star of this movie, and I insisted. But while I was making the movie, I had no idea. I thought I was going to be in the next Gremlins or the next Labyrinth or whatnot. You know, that's the only frame of reference I had in my mind.
Sure, yeah.
I think I knew I wasn't doing Shakespeare in the Park, but it was a big role in a movie. And at that point, you know, in your career, any movie seems like, you know, maybe this could be your big break. There's no way you could have predicted 20 years later that it would have taken on the life that it's taken. At the time, I knew it wasn't high art, but I also never sensed that it was high camp either.
Right, right. Let's talk about the life it's kind of taken, the course this film has taken, starting with when it was first released and your first reaction when you finally saw it. I know that some of you were probably, I think I read that some of you were horrified. but clarify that for me. Doctor, when you first saw it, what were your thoughts?
I tell some of the audience that when they have Q&As after a screening, they ask that same question. And I can always remember, you know, I remember putting that VHS copy in, the old VHS players, you know, and I remember seeing the first maybe 5 minutes and where me and Margot Prey are on the couch and then it goes into another scene or something, and I'm just going, "Oh my gosh." And I remember honestly taking that VHS out of the thing, and I couldn't watch it anymore. And I don't think I watched that VHS copy. It ended up on my shelf for what, 16, 17 years, and I never saw Troll 2 to its completion until the first screening in New York City. Isn't that something?
Wow.
Yeah.
I understand that one of you guys were doing missionary work when it came out.
Yeah, that was me. This is Jason. I was actually in Spain at the time on a mission for my church, and I just got a letter from my parents just saying, "It's out, your movie's out, Troll 2 is out." And my first reaction was, "What is Troll 2? I'm not in Troll 2, I'm in Goblin." But they're just like, and then I just started receiving letters from my friends and people I hadn't heard from forever. Everyone like, "I saw you on HBO, I saw you when I was watching TV late night last night." And then they started quoting all these lines like, "Don't fret" and "Be flowering Millbox virgins" and all this stuff. And I was like, "Oh, great." So, yeah, I did not even want to deal with it. And luckily, I didn't have to. So I didn't watch it until I came home. And at first, I was terrified. But then I thought, "Oh, it's kind of fun. I'll run with it."
Yeah. Michael, did you guys, did you keep touch with anyone, any of your castmates throughout the years at all?
I didn't. I think I bumped into Connie a couple of times, my sister, at different auditions, but I didn't really keep any sort of contact with anyone up until right before I started the documentary.
Right. So Michael, tell me about, you had obviously kept pursuing a career in the industry throughout the years, and I want to know from all of you, starting with you, Michael, when you first realized that this movie had become a sort of cult phenomenon.
Okay. Yeah, I, from the time I was 10,
up until I actually served a mission for my church as well, I continued to act and do other, you know, movies of the week and commercials and roles here and there. I lived in Los Angeles off and on for several years, kind of during pilot season, just trying to work as an actor. I really, after realizing what Troll 2 was, and the first time I saw it was on Christmas morning, about a year and a half later, after with my whole family. My family had found it. Nobody had seen it, and they surprised me with it. And we put it in and watched it, and I just remember my dad kind of putting his hand in his head, or his head in his hands, and saying, "Man, Michael, this is a bad movie." And just being like, "Oh, man, that's not my movie, is it?" You know, just being totally blown away. And I really didn't want anything to do with Troll 2. I felt like I was almost too good for Troll 2. I just felt like that's the past. I didn't want anything to do with it. I'm working on other movies and trying to find other roles. And I just ran. I really ran from Troll 2. I didn't like it. And about 3.5 years ago, I started, out of nowhere, I started getting emails from, or MySpace messages from 20-something, you know, kids saying that they were fans of this movie. And at first, I didn't know what to think of it. You know, I thought it was some sort of a joke. I've never been really a B-movie lover. I didn't know a lot about it. And so I didn't really get it. And I looked, eventually I they would send emails of these parties that they were having, you know, where there'd be 7 or 8 kids in a basement watching Troll 2 and dressing up and eating green cupcakes. And from those pictures and from the genuine fun that they were having around this movie, I became really, really interested. It was just fascinating to me.
Yeah,
and I would see you know, these kids list. I would see their favorite films on MySpace, and nestled right in the middle of, you know, Shawshank Redemption and Spider-Man, there'd be Troll 2. Or you would, and I'd think, what in the world's going on with this? And I started, you know, to correspond a little bit with the fans and through email and you know, social networking websites and really. Really became like just compelled to learn more, and then one morning it was, I mean, as clear as anything, I woke up one morning and I just remember staring at the ceiling and thinking, wait a minute, you know, I'm the star of the worst movie ever made. Think of all the movies, and I just smiled, and it felt like it just felt really really like special, and I turned to my wife and I said, I have to document this. There's a story here. There's a documentary here. And immediately it was like best worst movie. And soon after, I was in touch with George and I said, I'm going to do this crazy thing. And George, of course, was first in line and said, let's do it. Let's go to these screenings. And that's, you know, ever since then, it's been just this unbelievably fun and insightful and wild ride.
Yeah. George, what do you think they're responding to, the fans, when they watch the movie today?
You're talking about the best worst movie?
I'm talking about Troll 2.
It's really hard to say. There's a lot about it. I think it's just something that most people are used to seeing. It's just so odd and so different, and the lines are just absolutely something you've never heard before. I think, whereas, like, people in Rocky Horror, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, it's a musical and the characters behind that, but ours, it's all about the lines, you know, and the story plot, too, and
yeah,
the fact that there's no blood, it's all green, and then, you know, just these absurd, wild things. I mean, where did they come up with that? You know, where did that line come from? Or, oh my gosh, I mean, did I really hear what I just heard? You know, it's like nobody's ever heard this before. It's just like, whoa, man.
Tell me, guys, a little bit about your encounters with the fans of this film, the strangest encounters or the most memorable encounters you guys have had. Darren, if you want to start out with that.
The strange encounters are when you meet somebody who is a complete fanatic about perhaps your particular character or your line, and they know all of the dialogue from the film, and they'll come up and they'll have your picture on a T-shirt, or they will have handmade a costume of your character, and they come up, and it's sort of like a community. It's actually a very gratifying feeling to feel that, you know, something that you should potentially be embarrassed of is something that people have embraced and have enjoyed and been entertained by. So I really found nothing but joy interacting with fans, and it hasn't been a golly, I'm famous kind of thing. It's been more of I've met people who are as weird as I am, and I'm comfortable with that.
Do they always ask you to say your most famous line from the film?
Do, yes. Quite a bit.
They're eating her. And then they're going to eat me. Oh, my God!
Jason, how about you? What kind of encounters have you had with the fans?
I would say, you know, it's all been kind of strange for me, really. I think some of the most interesting times when girls want me to sign their breasts.
Wow.
Or sign their shirts, things like that. I mean, you know, because I'm, you know, I think they look at me and think I'd probably do it. So, you know, that's been kind of strange. And then just really when running into fans and that and have them start shaking, some of them actually start, like, tearing up, things like that. And they're like, oh, my gosh, I've grown up with you. I've grown up with you the last 18 years. And you're just like, wow, you know, just internalizing that. So it's been kind of a trip for me all the way around.
Yeah. Michael, when you're putting this documentary together, because oftentimes when you start on a project like this, you have preconceived notions about what it will be, and then it becomes hopefully a lot more kind of richer in theme. Did you find something greater than what you thought that you started out with?
You know, it's interesting because it certainly, like any, I mean, I've been working on it now for three and a half years, and it continued to, the project continued to mature, and I was surprised left and right with things. But from the very beginning, what interested me about this was not necessarily the fandom and not so much the pop cultural, you know, reference to it or even the underground fans. It was the sincerity behind everything. It wasn't just fans, it was sincerity of the characters, the sincerity of the director, Claudio Fragasso. And it was more of a, it became much more of early on, I wanted to tell a story that was character driven and that was not a behind the scenes, you know, expose of the worst movie ever made. I wanted to tell the story from people who were involved in this and actually kind of get to know these people and get inside their heads as far as what they were thinking as this movie, you know, that we were all associated with, rose from, you know, embarrassment to cherished cult classic. And it's become somewhat of a love letter between kind of a dysfunctional family of sorts, I suppose. It's never, and an interesting thing I'd like to point out is I've told everybody this, but upon having the idea, it was never maybe I should do this, maybe I shouldn't. I mean, from day one, I've been just committed because I knew that there was something here, and it really, like, consumed me, and I cared so deeply about what was happening and had a feeling that the characters that I would encounter, I would care so deeply about that it kept me chugging along until it was done.
Mm. I want to know from the rest of you, obviously, with this film, Best Worst Movie, it kind of brings this journey full circle. I want to know what this entire journey has meant to you guys in your lives. So, George, if you want to start out with that.
Well, you know, as I'm one of the people, four of us here listening in on everybody, I'm a little emotional right now to tell you how I really feel about the other three people that I hear talking. It's because, for me, the relationships that we've built is just amazing. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, the last time I saw Michael, he was 10 years old. And then I see him when he's 28, you know, 18 years later. And the same thing for Darren and Jason. You know, I just, I know Jason was 17 and Darren was, 20 or what have you. And you know, that's been, I think, one of the most beautiful parts of doing this documentary is the relationships that we've built. And when Michael and I took this project on, we just said to ourselves that we just looked at each other in the eye one day and we just said, you know, if we're going to do this, let's put the spiritual aspect of this first and the material second. Meaning, you know, we just went with our spirits, and I am one to operate from my heart more than my head, and I knew that Michael was that way in order to take on a project like this. And so the beautiful part of this whole documentary is that it's really amazing, but everyone that has been a part of really the actual making of it, the people that have been brought together, and Katie and Andrew, Katie Graham and Andrew, and then other people that Michael brought into it, it's just been a fantastic ride. And so I'm thrilled. And when I saw the documentary, I like Darren said, it just blows your socks off. When I got through the first screening, which, mind you, I saw it for the first time, last Saturday, after being documented for 2.5 years with a camera on me, and then again saw it last night with a packed crowd of 800, and everybody has come up. I mean, film critics, other actors, everybody's just storming us going, we've seen 20, 30 movies here this week, and by far, this is over the top. This is the number one film we've seen here in South by Southwest, and I think, like we all, we're just shocked. This has just been fantastic response.
Yeah. Jason, what has this experience been to you?
It's been very similar for me. This, you know, it's been all about, I look over the last 2.5, 3 years of going to these screenings, getting in contact with the rest of the cast, and really it's just been a pleasure, and just to get to know, you know, Michael and George and Darren and these wonderfully talented, cool people, and going to the screenings over the last couple of years, for me personally, has had nothing to do with being part of this movie, and it has everything to do with just hanging out with these guys and also getting to know these fans, getting to get in the mind of these fans, getting to know them as people and their lives, and it's just been this, like, amazingly rich experience for me, and as a product of this, we have this incredible movie. But for me, honestly, it's been building these relationships and these friendships and this life experience that's going to go far past this movie for me.
Darren, how about you? Any thoughts on that?
Ditto's from this side of the phone conversation, and in fact, George just kind of gets me into that emotional place anyway, so he's got me a little emotional, and I really think that's what is at the core of all of it. This isn't a making of the worst movie ever made. Best worst movie, and much to Michael's credit, is very human. It's very real. It's about film, and it's about heart, and it's about people, and it's actually, for me, because I've been taking this journey for 2.5 years with these guys, it's not all sunshine and roses in the film. There are times when it's a little bit difficult, and I actually find parts of it a little bit painful to watch. And that, certainly, and I don't mean that as a criticism of the film, it's more of a compliment to how honest and straightforward
the storytelling is that Michael isn't just making a film about, oh, look at, you know, this wonderful thing that has happened. It's more about relationships and how we relate to one another. And I really do have to thank that insane man over in Italy, Claudio Fragasso, for bringing us together and associating me. Sorry, my voice is cracking, I have laryngitis, with all of these fine gentlemen here on the phone with us.
Yeah, it sounds very cathartic, because not only do you rejoin your family from nearly 20 years ago, but you also discover a larger family out there of fans, and it seems like a real camaraderie and a common bond that you guys have found. Michael, tell me about the future of this film. What are the plans to get it out there and seen?
Well, the future of Best Worst Movie, you know, we started our festival circuit here at South by Southwest, which has been a complete honor. I mean, Austin is such an incredible city, and we've had so much really love and support, you know, going into this festival. And from here, we'll continue doing the festival circuit. We found out that we were accepted into Hot Docs.
Whoa.
Do we have, I guess we had technical difficulties there.
Yeah, we did.
Sorry, I don't know what quite happened.
Mm.
But that was the final minute of the conversation.
Oh,
they've
okay.
been accepted into Hot Docs, and then they're going to travel other film festivals, and they've had a few offers for distribution, but they're going to take their time. They're really
right.
going to nurture this film and this process. You can read more about it. I just posted up the website there at www.bestworstmovie.com, which also doubles as the official website of Troll 2, because certainly that film needs an official website for all of its legions of fans to gather and congregate.
Yeah, there you go, man. Legions. Legions of fans.
It's a great story.
Dude, it's an awesome story. I mean, who would have thought? You know, that's the whole thing about some of these documentaries. You think, well, who would have thought? And sure enough, it makes a very compelling film.
Yeah. Jerry, do you have a favorite worst movie?
I have so many. I'm just trying to think in terms of the context of what they're talking about. Like, just there's a movie that was actually made in my neck of the woods, actually, in the late 70s, that we used to watch all the time when it would come on late night UHF, if you kids who have cable or just have the internet, UHF is where all the bad movies are shown. But called The Alien Factor, which was filmed in Howard County.
Mm.
I think it might have cost $5,000 to make. And it's just one of those films that we'd always watch when it came on, and really the worst, like, low budget you could think of, but it was just always lots of fun. There are tons of, like, films like this that I can name for you. Humanoids from the Deep, that was actually a Roger Corman film. That was a big favorite that we'd watch all the time. But yeah, there's lots like that. And if you let me, Eric G's in the Avengers.
Yeah.
Oh my, that's not even good bad. That's just bad. I mean,
yeah.
Embarrassing.
But Connery in a bunny suit does have some sort of
it does
appeal.
It does. Oh, Joel mentioned a good one. The Stuff. The Stuff is actually, you know, Joel. This Stuff holds up surprisingly well. Garrett,
I thought
Morris
of watching that again. I have that on my cable system here, and I thought of actually looking at that.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually quite a beloved movie, and I remember seeing that when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and someone else in the chat room, I believe Robert mentioned Manos, the Hands of Fate.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is EW did a special on this film, I think, a special article on this movie a couple of years ago. And that's one of the very tippity top of the IMDb list. And Manos, I think, is Spanish or something for hands. So the actual title of the movie is Hands, The Hands of Fate.
Well, Bobby, my good friend Bobby Morgan in the chat room, I mentioned Q, The Winged Serpent, which had Bill himself, David Carradine's in. I love that film. Actually, a lot of those Larry Cohen films, like It's Alive 1 and 2, The Stuff. I love those films. I mean, yeah, they're bad, but they're so much fun to watch.
Well, and there are different categories of this, too.
Some
films set out to do that, and set out to be bad, and I'm not sure that you can do that intentionally. I think it has to
just kind of accidentally occur that you've made the worst movie ever made?
Well, Kevin Costner did it with Dragonfly. I think they set out to make something really bad, but all right, maybe not.
Man, where did that come from? Currently, here are some titles on the IMDb bottom 100 movies as voted by their users. Number one, with 11,600 votes, is the Jonas Brothers 3D concert movie. That must have been some kind of campaign that they had going. Go here and vote for this. Manos is on there, so is Super Babies, Baby Geniuses 2. A movie called That from 1975.
I think you wouldn't... They're not. Some of these are just bad movies. All right, okay. Yeah,
when I read something like Zat being one of the worst movies of all time, I always say, "What's that?" apparently, it's about Hydro will rip at your senses and plunge you into a quagmire of revulsion.
Wow.
I'm there already.
Yeah, I mean, let's go to Netflix right now.
Disaster movies there.
But these aren't real. These are bad movies to begin. These aren't even good bad movies, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a good bad movie list, though.
Yeah.
This is just bad movie from Justin to Kelly. I'm trying to see if there's anything that would strike our fancy as a good bad movie. Car 54. Bad Girls from Valley High. I'm not sure what that is, but I'm looking it up.
That's
right
so far the most promising one on the list.
I think so. I think that's got my vote. The Hottie and the Naughty. So there you go.
Yeah, these are just things that it's like saying that Big Mama's House 2 is the worst movie of the year. I mean, it's like, the thing is, did you walk in thinking that was going to be anything other than, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Someone else that's made their share of bad movies is William Friedkin. And in connection to that...
Oh, no.
The king of the segue. And our upcoming two-year anniversary on April 15th. Our very first show opened with one of our great friends, Chris, and he was a frequent contributor and co-host in the early days, and he comes back occasionally. But we said, wouldn't it be great if we open up every show with an impression? And that lasted exactly one show. And I wanted the first show. Yeah, remember this?
Yes, I do.
I wanted the first show to be just like outside and obscure enough to let people know, yeah, we're real movie fans, but this will be a more fun, irreverent show. So, with that in mind, as a little preview of our upcoming two-year anniversary, I wanted to play the uncut clip of Chris's introduction as William Friedkin.
Makes me want to go watch Jade right now.
This is good stuff. And just to let you guys know about William Friedkin, actually our friend Aaron interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. Friedkin has obviously made some landmark movies. He's also made his share of clunkers. But but what we're parroting more than anything else was the incredible ego of Mr. Friedkin. That's why we find him amusing. let's play this. This is fun stuff.
Hello, William Friedkin here, the director of such classics as The Exorcist, French Connection, Jade, The Sorcerer. I was going to call it The Sorcerer, but we ended up going with just Sorcerer. These are all my films. Of course, I was there for the inception of many, many others. Wedding Crashers, for instance. Jurassic Park was basically my idea and somewhat inspired by a true story that happened to me. But I'm not here to talk about my career, which also includes, you know, other realms besides film. For instance, I was instrumental in innovating streetlights. You know, before I came along, it was just two colors. It was red and green. And I said, listen, guys, sometimes you've got to use caution. You know, maybe a yellow light. And they said, you know, Bill, I think that's a good idea. And so basically, you have me to thank for yellow lights. Like I said, I'm not here to talk about myself. I certainly can. I also invented many other things. I invented, there's so many, the light bulb, the gas grill. I invented streets. No one was driving on gravel, you know, before I came up with the idea to pave roads. It was basically my idea. Lawyers in Love. Basically my song. But like I said, I'm here to speak about Movie Geek United. which is also my idea, but I've given it to these fellows, Jerry, Jamie, and Chris, to sort of run with it. No one was putting movie talk on the internet before I came up with it. And I said to these guys, just do it, see how it pans out. If it doesn't work, come back to me and I'll fix it. But this is their first show, so, you know, give it a listen, give them a try. Remember, I'm not going to be there for the whole thing. Obviously, if I was, it would be a huge success. And we'll see. Maybe that will happen. Perhaps I'll pop in again. But for now, enjoy the show and let these guys take you on a little ride. That was basically my idea.
That's great. I remember that, man. God, it's been 2 years already. Wow.
I think we need to bring Friedkin back for the 2 year.
I think we do.
Yeah. Obviously, he's a wonderful filmmaker. We're poking a little fun.
Yeah, poking.
I remember being in the studio when he recorded that, and we did five or six takes on it, and he'd come up with these things out of the blue. Lawyers in Love, basically my song. I'm like, where did that come from? Just out of the blue. That's good stuff. We're going to be back Wednesday night. We're going to have our two-hour Sarasota Film Festival show with Joey Pants and five or six other really fascinating guys and gals, filmmakers that have tackled very daring subjects, interesting subjects for their films that will be shown there, and that'll be a good show. We haven't discussed Natasha Richardson yet on the show.
No, we haven't. We should do that.
Or Ron Silver, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Two of our great actors, by all accounts, two of our great stage actors, beyond movies and TV, that we've lost. Very tragically lost. Both of them are tragic, but for Natasha Richardson in particular, such an unexpected loss.
Right, yeah. Well, both are. Both were. I did not know, about Ron Silver and his battle with cancer. I honestly did not know about that. So when my brother told me the news that, I think it was 2 weeks ago,
yeah,
that was very shocking. And the thing with Natasha Richardson, it's just two massive losses.
Obviously Richardson came from a very strong acting lineage.
Mm-hmm. The Red Crows,
and she, I took her for granted somewhat. I mean, I liked her work. I never realized how beautiful she was for some reason until I started seeing the previous interviews and the previous photos that have popped up online. She's a gorgeous woman and extremely talented. I wish I would have been able to see her version of Cabaret, which I hear was among the most breathtaking of the works that she's done. But I always think of The Comfort of Strangers when I think of Natasha Richardson.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, too. That and The Handmaid's Tale. Mm. And then there are movies I saw in this decade that I actually liked. She was, very charming in the movie Blow Dry with Josh Harnett, and also in Waking Up in Reno with Billy Bob Thornton and Patrick Swayze and I think Charlize Theron, which was
she was in that.
Yeah, she was that was a variation on Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice, kind of for the new century, and that was a very funny movie. But she was in a lot of good movies, but it's really her stage work what she'll be remembered for, and rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to believe that she's not here.
Yeah, she won a Tony for Cabaret, and Ron Silver won a Tony for the Mamet play Speed the Plow. I think it was the first production of Speed the Plow, and that gained a lot of notoriety because it was Madonna's Broadway stage debut. Remember that, 88?
Yes, 1988. I do. But
Speed the Plow has recently been in London. I mean, we've covered it on the show with Goldblum and Spacey in London, so it's a great piece.
And I mean, it's, for me at least, Ron Silver is really sort of like the quintessential person I think of whenever I think of Alan Dershowitz because of his performance in Remarkable Fortune. Or I think he was wonderful in Enemies of Love Story.
Great
very
film.
Very good in those.
He was a very good actor and very comfortable. You're always comfortable with him, except in one role, which was Blue Steel.
True. That's right. That's right. He was in that. I forgot all about that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was like a kind of resurgence of sorts for Ron Silver because he played a complete and utter psycho.
Yeah.
Stalking Jamie Lee Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
Like a... great kind of psycho performance
yeah.
that he gave. And he was wonderful on The West Wing as a recurring character.
Yes, he was. He was.
And they brought him back in keeping with his own politics when he switched parties after 9/11, and that those kind of characteristics went over to his part in The West Wing,
right.
where he campaigned for Alan Alda's candidate in The West Wing, switching sides, so to speak.
And I understand. I think a lot of people don't understand, but there were a lot of people, a lot of liberals, who 9/11 really changed, made them rethink their priorities and their political standing. And I know in the, you know, a lot of just rub people the wrong way, some people the wrong way. But look, you know, that's their beliefs. It happens to people. No one stays the same forever. People do evolve. They change, and I accept that. And you know, Ron Silver always brought his A game to whatever he did,
mm-hmm.
and was exceptional. I think we would all agree that he was an exceptional actor to the very end.
Yeah.
Regardless,
I remember reading an EW review of Carlito's Way, and the critic said that Pacino reminded him of Ron Silver in that movie.
I see that. I can definitely see that.
For some reason, that sticks in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of Natasha Richardson and The Comfort of Strangers, if you haven't seen it yet, it is pure Schrader, man.
Yes, it is. It's classic Schrader.
To give you a sense of how challenging this film is, Chris Walken is in it. He has great monologues.
Yes, he does.
Chris Walken's wonderful whenever he has a monologue to perform. He says that out of all the movies he's done, Chris Walken says that The Comfort of Strangers is the only one that disturbed him. So
I think that says something right there. I mean, nothing else, not like, you know, anything to do with Abel Ferrara or anything, but that one. That's the movie right there.
Right.
I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's great. So if you want to see what scares Christopher Walken, watch The Comfort of Strangers. Now, you saw movies this weekend before we get out of here?
Well, why don't we just start with the funny story. I have seen Knowing, the new Nicolas Cage movie. I've only seen the first half hour, 45 minutes. The film broke down. I got a refund. I'm not really tempted to go back and watch the rest.
But in true fashion, keeping with the theme of the movie, can you predict the ending of it?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
I think I can. I think everyone got their money back. No, you know what it reminded me too much of, though, was the earlier Nicolas Cage film from a couple of years ago, another one that dealt with the end of the world, Next meets that Jim Carrey movie, The Number 23, and that's all I could really think of, at least during the parts that I'm watching. I realize now... it deals with basically the end of the world.
Yeah. And that's a winning combination.
Oh, right there. Yeah, I mean, if that doesn't get you, even though this is the number one movie this weekend, if that doesn't get you to the theater, I don't know what will.
Yeah, we were talking about pitching the other week. And if you went into a pitch meeting and said, Next meets The Number 23, I guarantee you, you're getting a green light, my friend.
Get a green light? I'd be lucky if I ever worked in catering as far as that goes.
You know, it's interesting. I was telling you, because the reviews have been mediocre at best, and then you have Roger Ebert, who called Dark City one of the great achievements in filmmaking.
I like Dark City a lot.
But
not Dark City.
Yeah, but you obviously know he's majorly on this filmmaker side, and he said the same thing about Knowing. It's one of our time's best sci-fi films, with a 4-star review, he said.
Yeah, I was when I saw that, the advertisement, I think it was yesterday, because I'd already seen half of the movie, but when I saw it, I was like, my God, he really just doesn't care what he says anymore. He's really going out there. He's just really going out there for
some
things.
He's going out there. He's very enthusiastic about films. That's what I've always liked about
him. Yeah, he is. You're absolutely right.
But I remember being taken by the vision of Dark City but not enjoying the film. But I only saw it once when it first came out, and maybe I wasn't as attentive as I should have been, so I'll check that out again.
Right.
So you also viewed I Love You, Man, and that works?
I think I Love You, Man is the funniest movie of the year, but of recent, really, because I didn't expect anything. It's like when I went to go see Forgetting Sarah Marshall, so I thought, okay, this looks like a... But I really love that movie, and on I Love You, Man, I could not stop laughing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really funny. And when Jason Segel enters the film, you will not be able to stop laughing. It's one of these great entrances, and I have to give the film this, Paul Rudd and Jason Segel, for this, I guess we want to call it a bromance, have better chemistry than most romantic comedies I've seen in the last decade.
Yeah. And let me just say, I love you too. So you saw another movie. What was the third movie that came out?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Sunshine Cleaning, which I'll just say a little bit. I still don't know really what to think about it yet. It's like a variation. It's by the same, I guess, people that brought you Little Miss Sunshine. And I noticed that it hits all these, like, I guess, sort of indie hallmarks, you will, or things you need to have in a movie. I mean, this movie stars Emily Blunt and Amy Adams as sisters who are going through rough times. Alan Arkin's her father. There's a little boy in it that's Amy Adams' son. It's trying to be very much like Little Miss Sunshine. I will say this. The reason Little Miss Sunshine works so well is because of the dysfunctional family dynamic. And they also gave those characters a lot more to do, like Greg Kinnear, Tony Collette, Abigail Breslin, but especially Steve Carell and Paul Dano. That dynamic is at least so far from what I'm thinking about it, that dynamic's not there. It seems like these films are pale imitations, if you will.
What do they do? They're like crime scene.
They clean up after crime scenes. They get in this thing of cleaning up after, they clean up the blood and everything, the guts and everything. And that's like, that has a big, I don't want to give away anything, but that has a big thing about what the background of the movie is.
Right.
That plays in.
You know, I almost did that line of work at one time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
A crime scene, really a transporter, transporting the victims to the coroner's office. From crime scenes.
Right.
And I was considering it because I thought it would be a tremendous experience. Obviously you're so weary of how will this affect me. But
mm-hmm.
at that time I was looking for something different. But I ended up not doing it.
No, and it's I can see why. It's an interesting... I just want to let everyone know. Jason O'Brien is back home from the gym. That was the latest status update. I just thought I'd let everyone know that.
Oh, good.
I'm sorry. I just had to.
I'm sure our thousands of archive listeners will wonder.
I know.
What's wrong with Jane? Those are the three movies. And Sunshine Cleaning's
three,
limited release, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Sunshine's unlimited, yeah.
Yeah, you get all those movies.
Yeah, we get all those movies, yeah.
Okay. Here's a funny story before we log off. I'm submitting more requests for the film festival through the film festival publicist. They're showing the movie Tyson.
Oh, cool.
So I request a few people, Woody Harrelson and a few others, associated with other movies. And then I say, could I have someone from Tyson, perhaps James Toback? And he responds back and says, I'll check on it, but James Toback might be a bit of a loose cannon.
Well, that's what we love. I love that documentary about him. It's so cool. All right.
So I wrote back and I said, oh, all right. Well, then how about Mike Tyson?
Yeah, there you go.
Will that be less of a loose cannon for you? Anyway, that was a funny story I just wanted to share.
Either one. I mean, come on.
Yeah. All right, guys. We had a great time.
We did.
We'll join you again Wednesday night, or please join us again Wednesday night. Pick up the book, The Invisible Cut, How Editors Make Movie Magic, from Bobby Osteen. Check out bestworstmovie.com for all the information on that film. And we'll see you back here Wednesday night for our big old two-hour Sarasota Film Festival show. It's going to be a great one. Jerry?
Good night, everyone. Good night, Jamie.
Good night, buddy. Thank you, man. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, Angelina Jolie.